This podcast is brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine, the monthly journal of risk management and accident prevention.
Hello, you're listening to Glenn Pugh for AvWeb.com. Earlier this year, events surrounding a court case showed that some people may be putting a little too much faith in aviation medicals. Simply put, to assume that someone's position as a professional pilot means that they're in excellent health is simply a mistake. But a pilot's health alone isn't the only medical safety concern in the modern cockpit. Today we're speaking with Brent Blue, a family and medical physician in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and a senior aviation medical examiner for over 25 years. Brent, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Glenn.
First, let's address the issue of pilot medicals. Does holding an FAA medical certificate necessarily mean that you're in good health? And are the implications different for holders of second, third, or first class medical certificates?
Well, it really doesn't mean you're necessarily in good health. The FAA medicals look at some basic self-reporting things from a historical point of view. And then we do physical examinations on pilots, and there are things that we can pick up, but in the history of medicine, there has never been a program that could accurately tell us whether someone is at risk for being suddenly incapacitated on a wide-scale basis. And the FAA's medicals are a little different because they are not allowed to assess risk outside of what is on the medical form. And to give you an example of that, if we have a pilot who comes into the office who has no medical history but is obese and a two-pack-a-day smoker, we can't do anything with that. So that means that this guy who, as a physician, I would say is at risk for problems, I can't do anything about his medical because I have no documented material that says to me this guy is at risk and I have no way to ask for more information. In other words, I can't order a stress EKG instead of the standard EKG that first-class pilots get after age 35. And those EKGs don't tell us much either.
Now, in spite of that, there have been efforts through the years to do away with the third-class medical, and to a large extent, the light sport category has addressed that, but of course, there are restrictions on the pilot in that case. What are the numbers? What percentage of aviation accidents can be attributed to medical causes?
Well, medical causes of actual accidents are less than 1% of any medical-related issue. And the FAA looks at that from the perspective that they must be doing a good job because there are so few medical causes for aviation accidents. But in actuality, the experience with balloons and gliders and light sport show that there are no more accidents in those groups because of medical reasons than there are in the regular third class group. And I should point out at this point that the only real difference between a third class medical and a first and second class medical as far as the requirements are mainly its hearing, its vision, and its EKGs for first class over age 35. Other than that, they're all exactly the same exam.
Based on our experience, then, do you think we might expect a change, particularly to third-class medicals?
I think the FAA is actually starting to float the idea of either dropping or relaxing third-class medicals. And the reason I say that is that it helps them from a budgetary point of view because they have had their budget cut, and with less medicals to review, that really helps the FAA's medical department as far as having enough personnel to do the job that they need to do. Plus, the FAA has shown some relaxation of third-class rules. For instance, now a person who's under age 35, their third-class medical is good for 5 years. Well, every doctor will tell you there is absolutely no way you can certify someone's health for a five-year period of time. Now, there is a FAR that says you're supposed to report any change in your health over the time period during the valid duration of a medical, but no one does that. I mean, just you have 600,000 pilots. They couldn't report that every time they have a hospitalization or a broken arm or something like that. It would overwhelm the FAA, so that just doesn't happen in the real life. But they have relaxed that, and they've also increased the duration of first-class medicals from 6 months to a year in those that are 35 and younger.
Well, and this, the point you brought up there, I think, is leading us down a different path. I know you're an advocate of the two-pilot cockpit as a different approach, as a different safeguard against medical problems. Can you explain your position on that?
Sure. The safest thing that we can do to protect an aircraft as far as medical incapacitation is having two pilots. And the FAA stance is that if someone pays for a ticket or pays for an aircraft ride, that they deserve a certain level of security. And certainly, I think the two-pilot crew for Part 121 scheduled airline operations is what does that, because the likelihood of having two pilots simultaneously incapacitated in the cockpit is just a number that is, I mean, as far as I know, it's never happened in the history of aviation unless there's been an explosion in the cockpit or something like that. The big problem is more in the second class area, where people will charter an aircraft and it may be a Citation that will carry six passengers, and that Citation may be a single pilot aircraft that only requires a single pilot crew. That is a little bit more worrisome for people who are paying for that flight. In third-class medicals, I think the FAA's attitude is that since someone is not paying for a ride in that aircraft, they assume a certain amount of risk that the FAA doesn't think that is their responsibility. It's the individual's responsibility. So the different classes have different areas, but probably the most risky area is flying with a single pilot Part 135 operation.
Well, have you seen any movement here from the FAA where it comes down on this matter for airlines and charters? Do you see any movement toward or away from requirement of two-person cockpits?
I've not seen any true movement as far as a movement away from a two-person cockpit for 121. I have seen some regulatory issues related to IFR operations for two-pilot cockpits, and of course, certain complexity of aircraft require two-pilot certifications. But there's still a big sort of void in medical certification for Part 135 operations. What the FAA plans, you never can tell. Who knows what they might come up with next?
You mentioned earlier that the FAA might be influenced by financial considerations on these matters. Could you elaborate a little bit on your thoughts there?
Well, I think the more pressure the FAA has from a budgetary point of view, the more they will look at dropping or extending, even to a greater extent, the third-class medical. And what I mean by extending the duration of validity of the third-class medical, because more than half of the pilots that they certify every year are third-class. And given the experience of how many medical-related accidents there are, doing away with the third-class or extending them the duration considerably would reduce the workload for the FAA's medical office and help them with their budgetary constraints.
Well, where do you see this going in the broader sense, and I suppose more important, what would you like to see regarding the practical, effective implementation of medical regulation in aviation, both for Sunday flyers and professional pilots?
Well, I'm always have been in favor of dropping third-class medicals, with the exception of some self-certification issues. In other words, I think that there are some people who probably shouldn't be in aircraft, and those are people like those who suffer from epilepsy and people who have drug and alcohol issues. I mean, those are people that shouldn't be in cockpits, but you don't need a medical exam to determine that. That's essentially a self-reported exam, because somebody could come in and have epilepsy and not report it on their third-class medical and get their medical without any difficulty at all. There's no way we would be able to tell that. Same thing for somebody who abuses drugs or alcohol. It's, in essence, a self-reporting system, unless, of course, the legal system is involved. I think that that's the most reasonable approach for third-class. For first-class, I think for scheduled airlines, we have to maintain a two-pilot crew, and that's in spite of the amount of instrumentation that airliners have and the amount of computer power that they currently operate with. If you look at the A380 accident that happened with the Qantas engine that exploded, there were not only the two pilots, but the two Czech pilots on board that aircraft when it happened, and the reports show how valuable it was to have those extra people. Not to say that the two pilots themselves, the two required pilots, couldn't have done it by themselves, but it made things a lot easier. If that had been a single pilot airplane, I'm not sure that that pilot could have got that plane on the ground, even with all the help of his computers, because the computers didn't know exactly what was going on.
We've been speaking with Brent Blue, Senior Aviation Medical Examiner for over 25 years. Find him online at aeromedix.com. That's aeromedix.com. This has been Glenn Pugh for avweb.com. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been brought to you by Aviation Safety Magazine. For more on aviation safety, log on to www.aviationsafetymagazine.com.